This program is intended for a print impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. It's Tuesday, June 16th, and in the next hour, we'll be bringing you news from the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Paula Simchak. After more than 2 weeks on the picket line, union school bus drivers and monitors serving Marlboro Public Schools and the Advanced Math and Science Academy Charter School have reached a new agreement with NRT Bus. The drivers and monitors, represented by Teamsters Local 170, went on strike on May 27th after their contract expired on May 24th. Teamsters business agent Jim Marks previously said that union members were seeking a successor agreement that provided improved health care, retirement benefits, and bus safety measures. Marks told the Daily News on Friday, June 12th, that a new contract was voted on and ratified earlier that day, and drivers will return to work on Monday. "We got good, strong health care that the members deserve, and other strong contractual needs in the contract. We went out for a purpose, and we achieved that purpose," Marks said. "The drivers are happy, and it's good to end the strike and get them back to doing what they do best." NRT Bus also confirmed the agreement in an email on Friday afternoon to the Daily News. "We have reached an agreement with the Teamsters and look forward to our drivers returning to work on Monday," a spokesperson for the company said. In a statement released on Friday, Marlboro school officials said they were pleased the strike would end. "This resolution enables us to continue transporting our students to and from school in a timely and safe manner as we approach the end of the school year," the district said in its statement. "We appreciate the efforts of both parties during the situation. This agreement represents a significant step forward toward restoring reliable transportation services, ensuring stability in our students' and families' daily routines." Marlboro Mayor J. Christian Dumais said he was thankful both sides were able to come to an agreement and return to normal operations. "I'm very pleased that this issue has been resolved and grateful to everyone who worked collaboratively to reach an agreement," the mayor said in a statement. "I want to thank our families and students for their patience throughout this challenging situation. I also appreciate the efforts of both the drivers and the bus company to resolve their differences, find common ground, and return drivers and monitors to work. The restoration of reliable transportation is important to our students, families, and schools, and I know many students will be excited to see their regular drivers again on Monday morning." The last day of school for Marlboro Public Schools is Monday, June 22nd. During the strike, drivers and monitors picketed outside the NRT facility on Fox Road in Hudson. 3 years ago, in May 2023, the union went on strike for 3 days before workers returned to their bus routes. At the time, local bus drivers cited a reduction in hours, as well as drivers of small buses and monitors failing to get a raise, as key issues that prevented them from signing a contract. The night before General George Washington took command of the Continental Army on July 3, 1775, he slept at the Williams Tavern. There's a marker in downtown Marlboro to honor its spot along the Knox Trail, the route Henry Knox took from New York to Massachusetts to bring captured cannons to the Continental Army. These are just two examples of Marlboro's rich history with the American Revolution. Residents were involved in the Revolution at the very beginning. On April 19, 1775, when word of the Battle of Lexington and Concord made its way to Marlboro, local militia members jumped into action. According to History of the Town of Marlboro, Middlesex County, Massachusetts, written by Charles Hudson in 1862, more than 180 men from Marlboro, Northboro, and Southboro, mostly farmers, answered the call for help. "The drums beat, the alarm is sounded, messengers are sent through the township, and in 2 or 3 short hours, over 180 men dropped their implements of toil, seized their muskets, and are on the march for the scene of action," Hudson's book reads. According to the book, it was too late for the militia to travel to Lexington and Concord. Instead, the men marched to Cambridge and monitored the redcoats, acting as a deterrent for them to go forward until a larger army could be organized. According to a history of the city by the Marlboro Historic Commission, several militiamen served for several months and in several battles, including during the Battle of Bunker Hill. On July 2nd, Washington stopped at the Williams Tavern in Marlboro, being escorted by an honor guard of prominent citizens of this and adjoining towns, and he then proceeded through Marlboro along the Post Road, accompanied by a military delegation from the Boston Battlefront to Cambridge, where he took over General Artemus Ward's command, according to the Historic Commission. That was neither the first nor last time Washington visited William's Tavern, which was originally built in 1656, and then, after a fire, rebuilt in 1677. Washington first visited the tavern in 1756, then located at the intersection of West Main, Route 20, and Williams Streets, to meet with local politicians about the French and Indian War, according to William's Tavern, Marlborough's Lost Treasure, written for the Marlborough Historical Society by Linda Rennie. Washington returned on October 23, 1789, as President of the United States. The President was met by United States Marshal of the Massachusetts District, Jonathan Jackson, and they dined together at the tavern, according to William's Tavern. The tavern was torn down in 1947, although its front desk remains at the Marlborough Historical Society's Peter Rice Homestead on Elm Street. According to The Revolution in Marlborough by Paul Brodeur, trustee emeritus for the Marlborough Historical Society, a marker in downtown Marlborough honors the Knox Trail. One of the intriguing stories is the role Marlborough played in the manufacture of saltpeter. It was a prime ingredient of gunpowder, and the shortage of saltpeter made the heavy guns brought from New York inoperable, according to Brodeur's article. There was a concerted effort to develop local manufacturing of saltpeter, and Henry Barnes's potash ovens were a key asset. As early as 1775, this asset was utilized by the Army. In 1775, Amasa Davis, who participated in the Tea Party and later became a quartermaster in the Army, visited Marlborough and is mentioned in the letters of Christian Barnes. In all, nearly three-quarters of Marlborough's mill residents served at some point during the American Revolution. During the 8 years of this war, a total of 375 Marlborough men were in service, amounting to 25% of the population of the town, according to the Historical Commission. This is remarkable, as the scenes of action shifted more and more to the south as the war progressed. These men, of course, were not in service all at the same time, but when the war ended, at least 75% of the male population were veterans. Fortunately, however, the casualties were small. That amount, according to Hudson's book, was considered large for the size and location of Marlborough. Few, if any, towns situated as Marlborough was can boast of a more patriotic rally, he wrote. Marlborough will honor its role during the Revolutionary War beginning at 4 p.m. on Saturday, June 27th, with Celebrate 250, which will include a parade and muster. The parade starts at 4 p.m. at Main and Bolton Streets. The muster will be held at 5:30 p.m. at Ward Park, and will include a historical reenactment of a skirmish between the Lexington Militia and Redcoats, as well as musket drills, fife and drum music, and cannon firing. Community leaders, elected officials, and YMCA staff gathered on Friday, June 12th, to break ground on the future site of the Regional Early Learning Center, the first phase in building the Team Hoyt Community YMCA. More than 75 people attended the ceremony at 30 Memorial Drive, where construction on the Early Learning Center is scheduled to begin in July. The facility is expected to open in September 2027, according to Metro West YMCA President and CEO Rick McPherson. The new YMCA will serve families in Ashland, Framingham, Hopkinton, Holliston, and Sherborne, addressing rising demand for childcare, youth programs, and wellness services. McPherson described the Early Education Center as the foundation of a campus where children can begin in early learning programs and return for the YMCA's youth and wellness offerings as they grow older. Phase one represents an extraordinary investment in children, in families, and the future of our community, he said during Friday's groundbreaking. As the full vision becomes reality, this campus will grow into a place where people of all ages and abilities come together to learn, grow, and belong. U.S. Senator Ed Markey, Democrat, Massachusetts, was among those stopping by. He highlighted the need for a space such as the YMCA to provide a safe, supportive environment, especially in a world shaped by social media and technology. As these challenges continue to shape our world, we need spaces that nevertheless provide children with the resources, with the freedom, with the creativity to grow into whole, healthy, well-rounded people and community members, Markey said. Children may be a quarter of our population today, but they're 100% of our future. That's what this facility is all about. State Senate President Karen Spilka, Democrat Ashland, a former Metro West YMCA board member, said the center will help combat the growing problem of social isolation. Providing connections for individuals and families is the best antidote to social isolation and all of the harms, both personal and political, that social isolation brings, she said. This is what the Y does best. Showing every single person, no matter what their background, what their ability is, whoever they are, that they belong, and offering a helpful hand when times get tough. The YMCA is named for Team Hoyt, recognizing the legacy of Rick, Dick, and Judy Hoyt and their decades-long impact on inclusivity and education. Rick and Dick Hoyt, now both deceased, became widely known for competing in more than 1,000 endurance races, including 32 Boston Marathons, with Dick pushing his son Rick, who was born with cerebral palsy, in a specialized racing wheelchair. Their motto, "Yes, you can," set the groundwork for the Hoyt Foundation, established in 1989. The foundation continues their mission through charity runners in the Boston Marathon and year-round fundraising events. Russ Hoyt, president and CEO of Team Hoyt and the Hoyt Foundation, told the Daily News that seeing the family name on the building will reflect the influence his parents and brother had on countless community members. "What impacts me the most is knowing that Dad and Rick inspired a lot of people by running," Russ Hoyt said. "But my mother, Judy, actually changed the face of education when she got Rick into public school at a time when no one with a disability was allowed. Now you see a center like this one opening as one of the most inclusive early childhood centers. It's based on her work." The 12.5-acre site, located just off the Boston Marathon route on West Union Street, Route 135, was donated in 2018 by Ashland resident Bob Gaynor. Given the Hoyt's long history with the marathon, many at the event said the location could not be more fitting. The 9,500-square-foot Early Learning Center will include a full-day licensed childcare center. Phase two of the project will add a wellness and aquatic center, expected to host programs for cancer recovery, Parkinson's wellness, children's activities, aquatics, and general wellness. Russ Hoyt emphasized that the buildings are designed to not only be accessible, but fully inclusive. There will be no stairs or ramps, and visitors will enter at the same level as the parking lot. He said he has worked closely with architects to ensure the buildings can be used comfortably by all. Police in Hudson have announced that a local man has died as a result of a pedestrian crash that occurred downtown last weekend. In a press release, Hudson police said James Caff, 85, died due to injuries suffered in the crash, which occurred just before noon on Saturday, June 6, near 79 Main Street, across the street from Town Hall. According to the release, police responded after fielding several reports of a pedestrian being struck by a vehicle. Upon arrival, they found Caff suffering from injuries consistent with the crash, police said in the release. Caff was transported to an area hospital. On Monday, the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner contacted Hudson Police and said Caff was pronounced dead at the hospital. Police did not identify the driver of the vehicle involved in the crash. They did say the driver remained at the scene, according to the release. The crash remains under investigation by Hudson Police, the Massachusetts State Police's Accident Reconstruction Team, and the Middlesex District Attorney's Office. The long-awaited arrival of The Block in Natick Center is finally taking shape, with the complex's first restaurant just days from opening and construction underway for the rest of the development's dining lineup. The two-story mixed-use building at 1 South Main Street, Route 27, is set to become a new hub for Metro West restaurants. It will contain four ground-floor eateries and a second floor that will primarily focus on health and wellness businesses, property owner Stuart Rothman told the Daily News. Originally slated to open last year, The Block faced extended permitting delays that pushed back opening dates for its tenants. Rothman said the building itself is now fully complete, and interior construction is progressing inside the restaurant spaces. He emphasized that there's still a lot of work needed for the development to be complete, but that it's moving in the right direction. But after years of planning, he's eager to see the project finally come to life. "This has been in my head for years, and to see it actually functioning the way I had hoped it will be exciting," Rothman said. Blue Square Pizza will be the first to open, with owner Troy Spruill telling the Daily News that the restaurant's third location, his other two are in Hopkinton and Northboro, is expected to open between June 19th and June 25th. The Block's remaining restaurant spaces are still being built out. North Shore restaurateur Sa Nguyen is developing three concepts for the building, including Now, a restaurant inspired by Vietnamese social culture that's expected to open in the early fall. Nguyen's second concept, Sound Sushi Bar, will be a traditional neighborhood sushi spot. A third concept is still being finalized, but is planned as a takeout-focused street food operation. Planning for The Block began in 2021, 2 years after a massive 8-alarm fire destroyed the previous building on the site. Rothman said he wanted the redevelopment to give the community a place to gather, dine, and enjoy outdoor seating. A barbershop, Maverick Man's Grooming Center, has already opened at The Block. The Block sits near the Center for Arts in Natick, and Rothman said he expects theatergoers to stop in for dinner before shows. A central courtyard has been completed as part of the design and is intended for pop-ups, games, and community events as the development moves along. "It will be terrific for the downtown, and I see this as a kind of new-age kind of retail," Rothman said. I believe it's something that will be copied in other places and facilitated in downtowns, and I think this will be something people gravitate to. It will be exciting to see other people liking the concept and copying it. Framingham residents have a chance to share their thoughts on community development priorities at an upcoming public hearing. The hearing is set for 7 p.m. on Tuesday, June 16th, and will be held in a hybrid format, according to a community announcement. Attendees can either participate in person at the Executive Conference Room on the first floor of City Hall or join remotely via Zoom. The event marks the beginning of a 30-day public comment period for the city's fiscal 2027 Community Development Action Plan, according to the announcement. From June 17th to July 16th, Framingham will accept public feedback on community development priorities, housing needs, neighborhood improvements, and public services. The input gathered during the comment period will help shape the fiscal 2027 action plan before it's submitted to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, according to the announcement. Residents are encouraged to attend the hearing and provide input on community development priorities for the coming year. Reasonable accommodations and accessibility services are available for persons with disabilities, and translation services can be provided with advance notice. A federal agency is investigating an incident on Wednesday, June 10th, that left a tree worker with serious injuries who is trapped more than 100 feet off the ground in Southborough. The Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, is investigating the incident, which occurred about 8:20 a.m. on Pinecone Lane, according to Southborough Fire Chief Andrew Puntini. OSHA, which is part of the U.S. Department of Labor, investigates workplace injuries. It also sets workplace standards, conducts safety inspections, and issues penalties for violations. On Wednesday, the tree worker was working about 100 feet off the ground when he became stuck and injured, Puntini said. From what it appears, while the worker was cutting the top of the tree, the cutoff section moved in an unexpected way, causing injury and not allowing the worker to self-rescue, the fire chief explained. Although the man's current condition is unknown, Puntini said he suffered serious injuries that are not believed to be life-threatening. A Southborough firefighter was able to get the injured man down, and he was then transported by medical rescue helicopter to UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester. The man was working for a private company on private property, Puntini said. Gregor Camacho dropped his racket and pumped his fist after Newburyport's Yaman Kilic shot hit the net and fell harmlessly to the court. After playing for nearly 2 hours in the summer heat, the celebration said enough. The point secured a 6-4, 7-6, 9-7 win for Wayland's number 2 singles pair and ended a 4-1 Warriors win in the Division 3 state semifinals. It was the longest match of the season for Camacho, a freshman who is homeschooled but lives in Wayland. The heat and humidity on the St. John's prep courts didn't help, but tennis runs through Camacho's blood. He is the youngest of four siblings. They hit every night growing up, venturing inside in the winter months. His older sister Bella led the Warriors girls team to the Division II final last year and is now playing at Boston College. Older brother Alex won a state championship with the Warriors in 2022, and eldest sister Audrey played at Bryn Mawr. "I obviously started because of all my siblings started," Camacho said. "Then I started to fall in love with it as I was doing it, and it became a habitual thing. I love how this game teaches you a bunch of life lessons." Gregory joined the team a few weeks before the season started when Wayland girls coach Jason Tassinari reminded Warriors boys coach Sean Powers that he could. Powers texted his mother, Leilani, and asked if Gregory wanted to play. She responded, "Let me check." He did. While he learned aspects of the game from his siblings, Gregory's father, Van, instilled a bedrock technique and mentality. Van attended West Point and was an officer in the Army before working in business, finance, and computer programming. "My father definitely wasn't raised on a silver spoon," Gregory said. "He definitely had a lot of chips on his shoulder growing up. He taught me to use whatever I could to light that fire under me and keep going." Those tennis lessons also apply to life. One point at a time becomes doing one thing at a time. Good sportsmanship on the court means being a good person. "It's nice to get someone in there like that who's mature," Powers said. His game matured as the season progressed. Camacho can hit every shot, which can be both a benefit and a detriment. He tries challenging shots sometimes when a simple one would suffice. "He's got huge shots. His shots are better than my number one. But sometimes he'll go for the wrong shot at the wrong time and make a mistake," Powers said. "That's what was good about Wednesday. He finally put it together." Warrior senior Charlie Haddad and sophomore Kiyoshi Nimi paired up as the top doubles team for the first time in the season opener. Pairing doubles teams is an inexact science. Choosing a team's top three singles players is as simple as playing enough matches and see who wins to claim the spots. The remaining players need the correct skills and mindset. They have to be able to volley. You want them to be able to see in return, Powers said. It's better because not one of them is the dominant one. They're pretty equal and feed off of each other. Haddad and Miimi finished off their Newburyport opponents first in Wednesday's semifinal. Now we have a lot of ways to communicate. It's important to have a lot of trust in each other, especially when the matches get tight, Haddad said. We do a good job if we take the arches seriously, but we also know how to make some jokes, have fun together. When it gets brutal, it's important to stay positive. Tennis can be a lonely sport. There are no teammates to lean on, like pitchers, goalies, or quarterbacks, or officials to blame. It comes down to what you do with your body, the racket, and the ball. Doubles changes the dynamic to add a counterweight and someone to lean on. Time is most of it. Being positive because always blaming your teammate or not taking responsibility will drag the team apart. You need to own up to your mistakes and help each other out. Over time, you build stronger bonds, Miimi said. It's helpful to have a partner where if you're feeling down or doing bad, my partner will usually cheer me up. It's a lot nicer when there's someone to help you out. Number 1 Weston and number 2 Whalen will meet for the third time this season in the state final. The Wildcats prevailed both times, a 3-2 win on April 13th and a 4-1 in the rematch May 11th. There won't be any surprises, Powers said. Wayland is seeking its 10th state championship and first since 2023. It's the high-flying red, white, and blue colors that represent the United States of America, and Flag Day, which is coming soon, is a holiday that honors the flag. Starting the holiday to honor the flag came from many sources, but is most often credited to Bernard J. Sigrund, a Wisconsin schoolteacher, according to Britannica. In 1855, he urged his students to observe June 14th as Flag Day. He later wrote an essay published in a Chicago newspaper that urged Americans to proclaim this date as a day to celebrate the flag, the Britannica passage said. Flag Day is observed on June 14th each year. The holiday marks the day Continental Congress approved the design of a national flag in 1777, according to the Library of Congress online. While the idea for Flag Day emerged in 1855, Flag Day didn't become a national holiday until 1949, when President Harry Truman signed congressional legislation into law. As part of that, Truman gave a proclamation saying the U.S. flag should be displayed on all government buildings on that day. Flag Day is not an official federal holiday, so most establishments will remain open on June 14th. Did you know that Massachusetts has one of the highest concentrations of Albanian residents in the country? Elena and Bassem Mishkeri are hoping not only to take advantage of that fact, but to convince others that the southeastern European country's cuisine is worth a try. The Braintree couple recently opened their first full-service restaurant, Shkodra Burek, at 338 Washington Street. The new restaurant, which takes a spot most recently occupied by Mexican eatery El Centro, is named for the ancient Albanian city Shkodra, nestled between Lake Shkodër and the Accursed Mountains, where the Mishkeris are from. Burek means a filled baked pastry or savory pie. I wanted to do something that no one has done before, Elena Mishkeri said. Mishkeri is a self-taught chef who escaped Albania's then-communist dictatorship in 1988 at age 16, leaving with her family in the middle of the night in a kayak. She was with her father and seven others, including a brother and a sister. There was no motor on it, because if you made a noise, they would come and kill you, she recalled. They tried to shoot us, but we passed the border. The Mishkeris have had a catering business for 15 years, with a commissary at 980 Washington Street. Earlier in 1996, they opened Elena's Cafe, which offers fresh-baked byrek, as well as American and Mediterranean food for takeout and catering. Elena Mishkeri, who learned to cook from her mother, Averdita, said she always wanted to own a full-service restaurant, but waited until her children were grown. Mishkeri said everything is made from scratch at Shkodra Burek, including the burek, savory pies with cheese, spinach, or meat, a very different and very popular dish in Albania. We prepare everything by hand, Mishkeri said. We don't use any machines. Everything is made with fresh ingredients and is very flavorful. The recipes she uses are very old, she said. Some Albanian customers have heard about them, but have never eaten them before, Mishkeri said. Other signature offerings include tabe, dishes, baked meats and vegetables, often in clay pots, mancha, baked dumplings, and other staples, like stuffed cabbage, grilled meats, and yogurt-based dishes. The Mishkeris want those who experience Shkodër Burek to learn about Albania's culture and heritage. A sign above the kitchen says, Mirë se erdhët, which means, you are all welcome. The walls are decorated with Albanian art and artifacts like traditional dance costumes and historic photos. The couple plan to offer live music entertainment occasionally. Schadeburg is open for lunch and dinner from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Sunday through Thursday, and from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. on Friday and Saturday. Brunch is offered from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. According to Nielsberg census data, Massachusetts has one of the largest Albanian populations in the U.S. As of last fall, there were 20,752 Albanian residents, which is 0.3% of the state's overall population of just over 7 million. That's more than four times the national proportion of Albanians, which is 0.067%, according to Nielsberg. Massachusetts has a growing but still under-the-radar Albanian restaurant scene, according to the Albanian Business Connection. Every Sunday for the better part of a year, John M. Kahn would make the trek from his Framingham home to that of his daughter, Susan, in Brookline, and then he would get to work. He cut and recut, measured and remeasured, until he created an amazing set of bookshelves, Susan Kahn said. We designed it together, but he built it. That year-long bookshelf project is just one of many examples of John Kahn's relentless attention to detail. Whether at his day job as a high-powered litigator, in the evenings performing his numerous roles as a public servant in Framingham, or simply coming up with his next contraption as an accomplished weekend woodworker, Kahn gave it his all. He had amazing skills and intellect, said Framingham resident Mike Rossi, who served with Kahn on the Framingham Board of Selectmen and the Keefe Tech School Committee. I thought it was amazing that somebody with his experience and accomplishments would dedicate so much time to public service. That was an incentive for me to also serve. Kahn, a New Jersey native who landed in Framingham after his discharge from the Navy in 1957, died on May 30th. He was 95. Kahn's public service in Framingham stretches across about half a century. According to Susan Kahn and her sister Meredith M.J. Kahn of Tewksbury, he served as town council from 1968 to 1971, town moderator from 1974 to 1977, and two terms on the Board of Selectmen, 1997 to 2003, including a stint as chair in 2000, and three terms on the Keefe Tech School Committee, 2005 to 2014. City Council Chair George King can recall the Board of Selectmen voting 4-1 to hire King as town manager in 1999. He was the eye, King said of Kahn. But I can say he was extremely supportive from day one, always helpful and respectful. An ardent supporter of Framingham remaining a town, in April 2017, residents approved a charter change to make the municipality a city. Kahn also chaired the Zoning Board of Appeals and was also appointed to several municipal search committees. He was principled, consistent, and articulate, King said. There wasn't too much mystery about where he stood. We didn't always agree, but he served for a long time, and that's commendable. Outside of town affairs, Kahn served in many leadership roles at Temple Beth Shalom, including as president and chair of the Rabbi Search Committee. All that, and yet, he was an awesome dad, M.J. Kahn said. Even though he was really busy with town affairs, he had a lot of hobbies, and he always made time for us. Kahn showed ambition from a young age. His daughter said that at age 9, their father published about 15 editions of a neighborhood newspaper called the Mattawan Trumpet. And as a high school student, John participated in an American Legion-sponsored oratory contest, placing first in both his town and county, and then fourth statewide. Kahn was a 1951 graduate of Rutgers University, earning his law degree 3 years later from Harvard Law School, according to his obituary. He served in the Navy during the Korean War and eventually completed Officer Candidate School and Navy Supply Corps School. Kahn and his new wife, Rona Fisher Kahn, moved to Framingham in 1957 after he landed a job with Boston-based Peabody Kaufman & Brewer, later Hill & Barlow. Susan Kahn noted that another draw was that Kahn's parents lived in Uxbridge. As an attorney, Kahn was admitted to practice before numerous state and federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court and the United States Tax Court. His daughters recalled that his cases often involved representing mistreated workers. Both MJ and Susan Kahn said their father wasn't one to push public service onto his children, instead seeking to lead by example. They did recall him being proud when their late brother, Stephen Kahn, was elected to a municipal utility board in Greater Pittsburgh. Dad was never one to offer professional advice unless asked, Susan Kahn said. He wanted us to find our own way. He was supportive, but didn't push us in any particular direction. John Kahn was never afraid to speak up when he thought things were going awry. Rossi recalled an instance in the mid-1990s when he was serving on the Board of Selectmen and was leaning toward voting to renew the contract of an executive administrator. Kahn didn't think it was a good idea. John sent me a letter, I still have it, that made clear that I needed to open my aperture, so to speak, Rossi said. We did move on and hire somebody new. As for woodworking, in addition to crafting furniture for both his and for his daughter's homes, Kahn created miniature furniture and even caskets for beloved family pets, according to his obituary. He had woodworking shops in his basement and garage, but later added on to his house to accommodate his hobby. "I can still recall spending Saturdays in the shop and going to the drum with him, to the dump with him," MJ Kahn said. "We once built a bookcase together. Well, he did. I became very good at holding things." "He was a fantastic custom carpenter," added Rossi, who also served on Framingham's first city council in 2018 and 2019. "One time, some squirrels were coming around his home. They were really bothering him, so he built a device that was like a lazy Susan and hung it on a tree. It had room for 3 ears of corn, but when the squirrels jumped on it, the device would rotate and the squirrels would have to go upside down to eat anything. It was pretty funny." "Hear a brave heart like Burr while you're walking around downtown? Are some boisterous bagpipers making their way up your street? Those are just two telltale signs that the Scots have arrived. Scotland is playing in its first World Cup since 1998, and the fans have come out in force. According to a spokesperson for the Providence Tartan Army Instagram page, somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 Scots were expected to be in Providence. The likelihood of exceeding those numbers, according to multiple Scottish fans, is high. The Scottish national team's chances to go far in the competition are better than ever. But for fans like Neil Forbes, the chairman of the Tartan Army Sunshine Appeal organization that has donated more than $25,000 to various local children's charities, the team's performance isn't too important. "I've waited 28 years for this," Forbes said. "We're going to enjoy every minute of the experience here in the States." Scotland is one of the 48 teams that qualified for the men's 2026 FIFA World Cup, which will be played across the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Gillette Stadium, rebranded as Boston Stadium for the tournament, is set to host 7 World Cup games. Scotland will be playing in 2 of them, against Haiti on June 13th at 9 p.m. and Morocco on June 19th at 6 p.m. Many fans of teams set to play in Boston Stadium booked accommodations for Boston, but Scottish fans were turned away by the price. One Tartan Army member mentioned that Providence is closer to Boston Stadium than Boston is, and Scottish fans made the leap. Providence embraced the opportunity, according to Governor Dan McKee. The State Commerce Corporation invested $500,000 in maximizing the World Cup experience in Rhode Island. Rhode Island General Treasurer James Diosa called the city's opportunity a big effing deal. "Rhode Islanders have responded with kindness," according to the Scots. "Every person, to a man, to a woman," said Tartan Army member Ian Hendry. "I've never known a welcome like this." The tartan is a colorful wool weave with a plaid-like design, where horizontal and vertical stripes of colors cross and create patterns. The various designs are often seen on kilts and have been associated with different clans and families since the 1800s. According to Forbes, British journalists encountered masses of people wearing tartan kits as they went to watch Scotland play England in the 1970s. There they coined the term Tartan Army, which has stuck ever since. That unofficial anthem became a rallying cry for the Scots in 2024, when they qualified for a major tournament that would be played in front of fans for the first time since 1998. About 150,000 Scottish fans went to Germany as the team played in a tournament against other European teams. Most of them didn't go to watch. Scotland was only afforded 10,000 tickets to every game. Instead, they contributed to the party, leaving a lasting impression among other fans. German native Andy Sitzberger met the Tartan Army at that tournament in 2024. Germany plays World Cup games in Houston, Toronto, and New York this year, but Sitzberger planned his trip to Providence because he wanted to go where the Scottish fans were. He and many other American and international fans cited the kindness and passion of the Scots as reasons to appreciate them. The international community gets to witness that emotion for the first time in a generation. "I don't cry much, but I cried at the end of the Denmark game that qualified Scotland for the World Cup," said Tartan Army member Ross Wilson about the qualification. "It had been so long. A lot of grown men cried that day." The Providence Fan Zone at Station Park will be the main home of celebrations in the city. With streets closing down and bars receiving permission to stay open late into the night, the area is expected to be consistently vibrant. Providence Mayor Brett Smiley said they expect up to 13,000 fans to occupy the Fan Zone at once. "There will be several opportunities to reach that number. The Fan Zone will be open for all 39 days of the tournament." Going to Scotland's World Cup games with the Tartan Army would be the ultimate experience, but it would also be the priciest one. The cheapest tickets for a Scotland game, as of the afternoon of June 11th, are well above $500. Finances have been a reality, but not a concern in Scottish eyes. The total cost of the trip came out to between 5,000 and 10,000 British pounds, more than 13,000 US dollars for some. The mentality is simple for people such as Wilson, who said he has attended every Scotland home game for the last 10 years and brought his 16 and 17-year-old sons with him to America. "No one will check your bank account when you're dead," he said. He declined to say how much his trip cost, though, fearing his wife would find out. The biggest Scottish festivities will occur on June 18th. The event, called TA in the Park, will see bagpipers and fans march through the streets in a parade from 195 District Park. It'll take place a day before the Scots play Morocco, who beat Scotland in its last World Cup game back in 1998. The event will be sponsored by Guild Brewing Company and the IRNBRU. IRNBRU is a soda known as Scotland's other national drink alongside whiskey. For more than a century, it has been Scotland's top-selling soda, beating brands like Coca-Cola and Pepsi. A cold bottle of IRNBRU tastes like something. The exact recipe is a notorious secret, similar to Dr. Pepper. What we know is that 32 flavoring agents, and yes, a dash of iron, come together to create a singularly unique flavor. Forbes, the charity leader who also works as a Scottish tour operator, called it a nectar known for its powers. If you have a night on single malt Scotch whiskey, IRNBRU cures the head the next morning, he said. Whatever it may taste like, people tend to like it. The brew being readily available in America through TA in the Park is a bonus, too, given it usually has to be imported into the country from the main facility in the suburbs of Glasgow. "We don't expect to win the World Cup," said Tartan Army member John Fox. "We're just here to have a laugh, have fun, and enjoy ourselves." Scotland has never made it to the knockout stages of the World Cup, but this year provides our best opportunity to do that. In part, that comes down to the quality on the field. Several Scottish players are succeeding at the highest levels of the game internationally. Ask the fans how they feel about Scott McTominay, a wiry 6'4" workhorse who tends to score unbelievable goals, or Andrew Robertson, the grizzled veteran and feisty captain who flies down the left side of the field. Format changes also give the Scots a better chance to advance. Sitting next to his grandson on the gridiron on November 27, 2025, Sean Mahoney was all smiles. After being wheeled out to the 50-yard line of the Morgan Bowl by his trusted confidant, Jeff Rudzinski, Mahoney, seated in a wheelchair, joined his grandson, Seamus, for the opening coin toss of a Thanksgiving Day football tussle between Marlborough High and Hudson High. Nearly 7 months later, Mahoney, the longtime Marlborough High football coach, lost his battle with multiple system atrophy, MSA, a rare and aggressive neurodegenerative disease. Mahoney died on June 12th. He was 63 years old. He is survived by his wife Nikki, three children, Dan, James, Michaela, and grandson Seamus, among other family members. Information on funeral services is expected to be announced shortly. "Rest easy, Papa," wrote Seamus Mahoney on his Instagram story Friday morning with an old picture of him pulling a wagon full of hay with his grandfather seated on top. "Sean was a special guy," said Rudzinski, the former Marlborough High athletic director. "He was that friend that someone may not see for a long time, but when they did meet up, it was as if they never skipped a beat. He'll be missed for his quick wit and sense of humor, but most because he always thought of others first and made others feel good." Sean Mahoney had a standout football and baseball career at Worcester State before embarking on a Hall of Fame career coaching high school football. Mahoney started his coaching journey with the Shrewsbury High football team in 1994, and then spent 6 seasons as the head coach at Assumption University. The longtime Marlborough resident took over as head football coach at Marlborough High in 2004, just a few years before his grandson, Seamus, was born. Across 20 seasons on the Panthers sideline, Mahoney won 154 games. He was named the MIAA 2020-2021 Football Coach of the Year and was inducted into the Massachusetts High School Football Coaches Association Hall of Fame in 2024. He brought stability to the football program, but then, being in the building, he was somebody the kids always knew they could talk to about anything, Rudzinski told TNG last fall. "He was just that kind of person who had an open-door policy, and he did the right thing for the kids. That's the legacy he'll gladly leave." Mahoney, who also taught history at Marlborough High, was inducted into the Worcester State University Hall of Fame in 2018, alongside his daughter Michaela. A former standout softball pitcher at Worcester State, Michaela Mahoney da Silva, teaches in Marlborough and coaches field hockey and softball at Marlborough High. Her father previously coached girls basketball, among other sports, and for a time, some of Marlborough's female athletes played for a Mahoney across all 3 seasons. "The kids would joke, 'You sound just like Mahoney,'" Michaela told the TNG last fall. "I would say, 'I am a Mahoney.'" They got a lot of the same metaphors and motivational quotes from both of us. During the middle of the 2024 high school football season, Sean Mahoney started to experience symptoms that made it hard for him to get out of bed. He thought he had a bad back. It was worse than that. He is diagnosed with a neurodegenerative disease with no cure. Mahoney's last win as a Marlboro football coach came on October 12, 2024, a 27-14 victory over Fitchburg at Kelleher Field. In my eyes, Sean is Marlboro football. Current Marlboro football coach Ken Stokonis told the TNG last fall. Stokonis knew Mahoney for 25 years and served as his assistant coach for four seasons. One thing about Sean, if you know him, he's a solid person. He just does everything the right way. And that's what he did with the program. And that's why they had the success they had the last 20 years. Michaela Mahoney De Silva and her son Seamus moved from Derry, New Hampshire back to Marlboro nearly a decade ago. Having Dad and Papa nearby helped the transition. My dad used to rock Seamus to sleep humming fight songs, Michaela told the TNG last year. I'm never going to be able to hear a marching band drum and not think of my dad. And 7 months before he passed, Sean Mahoney got to share one final football memory with his grandson and family on Thanksgiving. I'm very fortunate to have the opportunity to be part of Seamus' last game, Mahoney wrote, along with his wife Nikki, in an email to the TNG last fall. He's the guy that taught me everything I know, Seamus Mahoney said. It's an honor. The man who shot and killed his brother in their Northbridge family home was sentenced to probation for 5 years after pleading guilty to manslaughter. Christopher LaCour, 34, had maintained the death of his brother, Jonathan S. John LaCour, 36, was an accident. Jonathan LaCour was shot and killed the night of May 21, 2025. 2 weeks later, his brother was charged with manslaughter. He initially pleaded not guilty. Wearing a black suit and glasses Wednesday, June 10, in Worcester Superior Court, Christopher LaCour changed his plea to guilty. His disabled mother, Darlene Perot, was in the courthouse. She was home at the time of the shooting. Judge Daniel M. Wren accepted the change of plea and sentenced Christopher LaCour to 5 years of probation, substance abuse evaluation, with necessary treatment, and no possession of firearms. Mark L. Monopoli, the attorney for the defense, recommended the agreed-upon 5 years of probation for his client, while Assistant District Attorney Thomas Ayers recommended that the defendant be sentenced to 3 to 5 years in state prison. Ayers said the brother's mother supports the probation sentence rather than prison time because, she said, she feels that she has lost one son already and losing another one would be devastating. As a precursor to the plea deal, Ayers presented the case against LaCour. Ayers said Christopher came home from work between 6:30 and 7 p.m. May 21, 2025 and consumed 8 Smirnoff vodka nips while having a Ruger American 9mm semi-automatic handgun in a holster on his hip. At some point during the night, while he was watching television from the couch, Christopher LaCour placed the firearm on his stomach because he was uncomfortable sitting with it, Ayers said. After 11 p.m., Jonathan LaCour came into the room, handled the gun, and placed it back on his brother's stomach, according to Ayers. Later in the evening, while Christopher was handling the gun, it fired, and Jonathan was struck in the chest, Ayers said. Jonathan LaCour was rushed to UMass Memorial Medical Center, University campus, in Worcester, where he was pronounced dead shortly after midnight. Christopher LaCour told Judge Wren that he has been an oil burner service technician for the last 4 years. Prior to that, he was a cook and landscaper for many years after finishing high school. Christopher LaCour told police he had pointed the gun at his brother as a joke and pulled the trigger, not realizing that his brother had racked around, according to court documents. Monopoly stressed Christopher LaCour had never previously been charged with a crime. At the time of the incident, he was a licensed gun owner who was legally in possession of the weapon. Jonathan LaCour was not only Christopher LaCour's older brother, but, according to Monopoly, the two men were best friends. Monopoly said the events of May 21, 2025 have a profound impact on the LaCour family. Christopher LaCour lives with the guilt of being the cause of the death of his best friend and brother, Monopoly said. Jonathan and Christopher's mother has been the most affected, Monopoly said. After Judge Wren wished Christopher LaCour good luck, LaCour pushed his mother out of the courtroom in a wheelchair. Looking to soak up this weekend's warm weather in the water? If you're planning a weekend swim, you'll want to avoid the freshwater swimming spots closed due to unsafe water. According to the Association to Preserve Cape Cod, APCC, swimming in water with high levels of cyanobacteria and the toxins it produces poses a threat of illness. Symptoms of cyanobacteria ingestion can range from headache and fever to a nausea and vomiting, or even serious liver damage, warns the Centers for Disease Control. Heading into this weekend, 3 freshwater swimming spots on the Cape are under bacteria alert or watch. Here's the full list. The following freshwater swimming spots listed by town are under alert as of Friday, June 12th. Barnstable, Bear's Pond, potential for concern. Hinckley's Pond, potential for concern. And in Brewster, Sheep Pond has a potential for concern. APCC partners with officials at the town, county, state, and federal levels to conduct cyanobacteria monitoring in Cape Cod ponds, collecting data biweekly. According to the APCC website, the agency typically recommends lifting advisories or closures after two consecutive tests a week apart show safe bacteria levels. The status of Cape Cod ponds can be checked on the website's cyanobacteria monitoring map. You could get caught for failing to stop at a red light, even if no policemen are present, under a bill in the Massachusetts legislature. Sponsored by Senator William Brownsberger, Democrat Belmont, S2344 would allow cities and towns to install automated cameras that would enforce road safety violations like running red lights, blocking intersections, and speeding. If passed, Massachusetts would join at least 22 states and the District of Columbia that use red light cameras, according to the CDC. The violations enforceable with the cameras include failing to stop at a red light, making an illegal right turn on red, exceeding the speed limit, and blocking an intersection. The cameras would take a photo of the violating vehicle's license plate and send a ticket to the owner. It prohibits pictures of the front of a vehicle to protect the driver's privacy. The owner of the vehicle will be liable for the fines on the vehicle, regardless of who was driving the vehicle at the time of the violation. Fines would range from $25 to $150, and revenues would go to the Massachusetts Transportation Trust Fund rather than the city or town. Cities and towns would vote on the location of the cameras and would have to produce an annual report with the locations as well as an analysis of safety data. The bill was reported favorably by the Senate Transportation Committee and now awaits a decision in the Senate Ways and Means Committee. It's unclear if the bill will pass by the end of the 2025-2026 legislative session. Kristen Carvalho, President and Chief Executive Officer of Mutual One Bank, was recently named the 2026 Champion for Women by the Massachusetts Bankers Association, Mass Bankers. The award is presented annually at the Women and Allies in Banking Conference. It recognizes leaders committed to supporting other women in the financial industry by exhibiting exceptional leadership skills and providing support to their team's growth. Carvalho joined Mutual One Bank as President, Chief Operating Officer, and Treasurer in 2022. And was named CEO in January 2025. She has more than 30 years of experience in the financial industry, including with several well-known New England banks. She holds an MBA from Bryant University and a Master's of Science in Financial Services and Banking from Suffolk University. In 2023, Carvalho earned a doctorate in Business Administration from the University of Rhode Island. Leslie Joannides Burgos of Franklin, Director of Retail Banking for Beacon Bank, was recently presented with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Massachusetts Bankers Association at its 2026 Women and Allies in Banking Conference. The award recognizes sustained excellence, leadership, and a meaningful commitment to advancing women in the banking industry. Joannides Burgos has more than 30 years of experience in the financial services industry in sales, service, operations, colleague engagement, and leadership. She has built a career focused on empowering teams and delivering exceptional customer experience. Beacon Bank has $24 billion in assets and more than 145 branches throughout New England and New York. Tracy Bartuka of Bellingham was recently hired as Vice President, Secondary Market Operations Manager at Bank Newport in Middletown, Rhode Island. She is responsible for providing oversight of secondary marketing operations, including loan delivery, investor compliance, pipeline management, and supervision of registration and post-closing staff. Bartuka previously spent 27 years with Main Street Bank in Marlboro, where she held mortgage operations and retail lending leadership roles, most recently serving as Vice President, Retail Lending Manager. She holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Sociology from the University of Connecticut. Yasmin Owesian was recently promoted from Assistant Vice President and Branch Manager to Vice President, Branch, and IRA Administrator at Mutual One Bank in Framingham and Natick. Owesian has been with the bank since 1999. She holds a degree in French literature from Lebanese University. She is also a graduate of the Massachusetts Bankers Association Leadership Program and has earned certifications from the Massachusetts Bankers Association Branch Management Development School and the Ascensus IRA Institute Online. Southern Avenue, a Memphis band known for its blend of roots, blues, and soul, will perform later this month at the Center for Arts in Natick, according to a community statement. The show is scheduled to start at 8 p.m. on Saturday, June 20th. Southern Avenue's unique sound combines original Memphis blues, modern soul, and gospel-infused roots music. The band is renowned for its inclusive, message-driven songs, hard-hitting grooves, and electrifying guitar work, according to the announcement. The band includes lead vocalist and songwriter Tyrannie Jackson, her husband, guitarist and songwriter Ori Neftali, and her sisters, drummer and vocalist Tikira Jackson and percussionist, violinist, and vocalist Ava Jackson. Through our music, Neftali said in a statement, we expand our family to include our fans and whomever is moved by our songs. In 2024, Southern Avenue joined the Outlaw Music Festival tour, performing alongside Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, and Bob Dylan, according to the announcement. Tickets for the June 20th show are $33 apiece. The Center for the Arts is at 14 Summer Street in downtown Natick. For more information, call 508-647-0097 or visit tcan.org. Marlboro is set to mark America's 250th birthday with a grand parade and muster, according to a community announcement. The event, organized by the city and the Marlboro Revolution 250 Committee, is scheduled for Saturday, June 27th, according to the announcement. The parade begins at 4 p.m. at Main and Bolton Streets, winding through the city and concluding at Ward Park, where a muster will start at 5:30 p.m. Admission is free. Parking is available at the parking garage behind City Hall and the Newton Street parking garage, with shuttle service provided to the event. The celebration will feature a parade with floats, vintage cars, fife and drum corps, color guard units, and community organizations, according to the announcement. One highlight will be a reenactment of a battle between the Lexington Militia and British Redcoats, transporting spectators back to 1775. The event culminates with a live artillery demonstration. Throughout the event, authentic 18th century military music will be performed by period musicians, according to the announcement. A tent, named for Old Williams' Tavern, built in 1665, will offer beer, wine, and other refreshments. Local restaurants, food trucks, and vendors will be at Ward Park, along with activities for children. Commemorative merchandise will be available through the Marlboro Historical Society. Visitors are encouraged to explore Marlboro's rich Revolutionary War history through library exhibits and a self-guided walking tour, according to the announcement. Various hotel options are available for those looking to extend their stay. The Marlboro Revolution 250 Committee was established by private citizens with a genuine interest in the city's history and its role in the American Revolution. It has been planning the June 27th event for 2.5 years, working in partnership with local organizations, businesses, historians, and community volunteers. The Northborough Select Board is interviewing the three finalists vying to become the town's next fire chief on Monday, June 8th. However, the board is not expected to make a choice at that time. The three finalists are Northborough Deputy Fire Chief Neil Espesi, now serving as acting chief, Franklin Battalion Chief Keith Darling, and West Boylston Fire Chief Mark Sadowski. They are seeking to replace David Parenti, who retired on March 31st after 10 years of service. Espesi has been acting chief since Parenti's retirement. Darling has been with the Franklin Fire Department since 2001. Sadowski has been fire chief in West Boylston since August 2022. Previously, he had been with the Southborough Fire Department for 21 years, rising to the rank of captain before leaving for West Boylston. Each candidate is scheduled for a 30-minute interview during Monday's select board meeting. Darling's interview is scheduled for 6:30 p.m., with Espesi's at 7 p.m. and Sadowski's at 7:30 p.m. The name of the pizza place in Melrose escaped France de Pirot. He figured it close since he left Melrose. That pizza, it was banging, Pirot said. The Haiti-born men's international soccer player recalled his upbringing in Massachusetts after making his World Cup debut in a familiar stadium in Foxborough on Saturday. Pirot played on the field at Gillette Stadium, branded Boston Stadium by FIFA for the World Cup, against the New England Revolution Academy team when he was a member of the Seacoast United Soccer Development Academy. He starred at Melrose High School on the soccer field and basketball court before continuing on to Northeastern. Going to school, and you take a walk, playing at the field, playing with my friends, everything, traveling, Pirot said, going to get a pizza, just the simple things that sometimes you miss it. His path took him from Boston to Coastal Carolina, the MLS, and European leagues. He's represented his birth nation internationally since 2018, but never like Saturday night in Foxborough. Haiti played its first World Cup game since 1974. It's an honor and pride. We can see that the whole country is proud of us. The whole country is looking at us, Pirot said. We represent them all over the world. It's an honor to be part of this history. Fellow Melan friends flooded him with ticket requests. Go past 30, he said. but also requests for time. Perot currently plays for Kayker Rizespor in Turkey on loan from AEK Athens in Greece. Between the European schedule and international commitments with Haiti, he doesn't come to Massachusetts much. There's not much time. I try to spend as much time as I can with my friends. My son is here. I've got to spend time with him. I'm trying to do recovery, Perot said. I'm trying to balance everything. A lot of people want to come see me. I can only see them for 2 minutes. They want to talk for a long time, and I've got a schedule to follow. The forward provided many of Haiti's most dangerous chances in a 1-0 loss against Scotland. He forced a point-blank save in the 35th minute after starting play outside the box. Perot also just missed a header with 5 minutes left that could have equalized the match and salvaged a point. They did their homework, Perot said. Those are the moments I want to do better. It's little things I need to fix, step by step. This was the first game. Kim Tanner, Art of Gardening member and master gardener, contributed over 300 plants to the club's plant sale May 9th. Tanner headed the fundraiser held at Pace Lutheran Church. Perennials, herbs, and houseplants were showcased on 9 tables in the church's parking lot. In addition to Tanner, members who provided additional plants and participated in the sale included Cherie Britton, Wendy Schmidt, Kathy Varner, Pat Edwards, Kathy Seawick, Kathy Barger, Skip Cather, Patty Stoffner, Dave Kowalka, Lee Heckman, Lana Parter, Ruth Ann Linder, Faith McKinley, and Claudia Dunn. Schmidt and Varner served as cashiers. Paxton Klein, 12, a sixth grader, started his own seeds for the garden this year, according to his mom, Katie. The Kleins of Savannah decided on purple iris, pink panther, which is foxglove, mint, ostrich fern, etc. He wants pansies, Emily Miller of Jeromesville said of her son, Griffin. Calder Levick was there with his grandpa, Steve Huber. The fifth grader stacked their wagon with French hollyhocks, sage, sweet basil, coreopsis, yellow, and tansy. Kelsa Temple, who lives outside Hayesville, said she is very new to gardening. After inquiring about Asian lily with Tanner, she went home with it and also decided on ornamental grass. She indicated that working and gardening are very therapeutic. Mary Ellen Lawrence held a box filled with bee balm, poppy salvia, and Brunera. Her friend, Mary Beth Barber, had a blue wagon holding a cardinal plant, celandine poppy, lady's mantle, hosta, hollyhock, mum, and pincemen, commonly known as beard tongue. Kim Hovey, excited about succulents and herbs, bought Solomon seal and lady's mantle. Rose Peters of Nankin and Pam Funk of Ashland had a red wagon full of Solomon seal, yellow loosestrife, night bloom, hostas, snow on the mountain, and ostrich fern. Aaron Clyburn and Lauren Larson took home Naked Lady and Nothing But Thyme. Norma Franks consulted Britton and Barger to finally settle on 2 Shasta Daisies, Blazing Star, Solomon Seal, and Huchera Coral Bells. According to parking lot scenery in a wagon was Britton's 3-year-old grandson, Damien. Slater Park delivers a neighborhood park experience with plenty of space to roam and areas for diverse outdoor recreation in Lansing Township. The 8.5-acre park, located at 2700 Mark Avenue in the Grosbeck neighborhood, features plenty of mature trees providing generous shade and wide-open grassy fields for casual strolls and other activities that require ample room. Benches tucked in the shade offer peaceful spots to sit and watch the world go by, and the large open green space is perfect for games or simply stretching out. The park is great for families with kids looking to burn off energy on the playground equipment or looking to use the basketball and tennis courts. Those looking for pickleball options can use the tennis courts that are also marked for the sport. A covered pavilion is available with picnic tables and a grill for gatherings or barbecues. Wildlife, including rabbits, squirrels, deer, blue jays, and other birds, frequent the park. The eastern border features a wooded area with pathways through thick plants and trees. Be sure to explore on the edge of the wooded area because the land becomes private property. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening.
When someone you know is struggling with vision loss, it can be challenging. But the Mass Commission for the Blind is here to help. We'll connect them to resources that will help them plan for the future with new skills and assistive technology. Find out if they're eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.